And the reason I got into it in the first place was I wanted to help other people before those crises happen. And if I can see my granddaughter go to school and learn about her mental health, right along with the rest of her health, when she learns about her eyes and she learns about her lungs and she learns about how her body works, I want her to learn about her mental health. And if she does that, then we're getting somewhere.
And that is what mental health literacy is all about and what it's for. Our guest on this episode is Annie Sleese, co-founder of the Mental Health Literacy Collaborative, and she'll share her story and the advocacy that means so much to her, her team, to all of us. Just a heads up, the story does include talk of suicidal ideation and possession of a weapon. Welcome to our podcast, Schizophrenia, Three Moms in the Trenches. From the place where schizophrenia and real life collide.
East Coast, West Coast, Middle America.
With Miriam Feldman, Mindy Greiling, and Randy Kay.
We are, my friends, at episode 88 already. I just heard from a listener today on Facebook who said, I just discovered your podcast. I started listening on episode one. And I'm like, well, I hope you have a lot of long walks to take because you've got 88 hours of listening to do. But as always, we tell you, you know, listen. I think listening to the first few episodes to see where we've come from is great. But then pick and choose the episodes that work for you, that is what you need to hear. You can kind of listen in any order. And we're just so delighted that you're here. We are three moms / authors / advocates, and we each have sons with schizophrenia. We've each written books about it, and this is episode 88 of our podcast, and we're so delighted that you're here. Today, we're going to be talking in a minute about something that, and Mindy, you brought this guest in, and I'm so grateful because I think each of us is painfully aware of the fact that when our sons were younger, at least I will speak for myself, it seemed to me that many counselors and practitioners in my son's school had no idea about mental health literacy. I wish it would have been hard to hear and to say, but I wish someone had said to me when I had the legal right to help him more than I do now because he's over 18, you know, it's possible these are early signs of schizophrenia. Here's what to look for. I know it's not what you want to hear, but here's a pamphlet. Here's a book to read just in case. And I think that would have changed our world. And I was very surprised to find that in some cases, I can't speak for all states, but I do know someone who just got their master's in school counseling, and studying mental illness was an elective. So I don't know if that's across the board. That was one particular experience, but that seems ridiculous to me. So that's our topic tonight. I guess when we bring our guest on, you guys can share your similar experiences with that. But I want to give Mimi a chance. I'm in Mimi mode tonight. If you're on YouTube, you say I'm in overalls. I'm an artist overalls. I did not change for the podcast. That's how long we've been going. I put lipstick on and that's it. But so Mimi, you just had a joyous time. Can you share a little bit?
My middle girl, Lucy, got married. And
congratulations.
Thank you. It really was wonderful. And, you know, you really, really appreciate when things go right, when so many things go wrong, you know, and mental illness and schizophrenia aside, anytime you get my whole extended family together, there's such a high probability for calamity that when everything goes smoothly, it's such a gift. And Nick was there and we tweaked his meds a little bit and got him there a day early because usually we go places with time change and then he sleeps the whole time. Mm. And he was handsome and magnanimous and talking to people and seeing people he hadn't seen in years. Mm. And it just meant the world to me. I mean, I'll say this for the other moms out there. I had this moment where I remembered Lucy, my daughter. This relationship has been a long relationship, and there was a period of time where they separated for a while and it looked like it wasn't going to work out. And I remember very clearly, I don't go to this place very often, but I remember very clearly thinking, damn it, can't anything for my family work out? Can't I have one like happy wedding? And what, you know, can't we be normal ever, ever, ever? Does everything have to get screwed up? And, you know, I had that low moment then. And then 2 years later, there we were at the wedding. And I thought, you know, all the good stuff doesn't go away. It just maybe is a little more infrequent, but it's also heightened by all the traumas and all the things that we go through with our kids. But what a beautiful day. I mean, it's just, you know, Randy, how you always say, making good memories. I felt that so acutely that it was just, this is a day, this is a moment that I'm going to come back to. We got this as a family. And Nick got it, and my daughter was so happy, and it was wonderful.
Yay.
Oh, yay. Jim was in Angela's wedding long ago. She's been married since for over 20 years now, and he wasn't doing well then. She really wanted her brother in the wedding. She gave him a couple roles. He was one of the groomsmen, but he wasn't doing well. So the you know he I don't think he even hardly enjoyed the wedding. He was in that stage, you know, where he wasn't enjoying anything. So I'm so glad that Nick had a different experience and you had a different experience.
It was a
Hooray.
wonderful day, and I am very grateful.
And I'm so glad to hear it. I want to remind, if you're new to the podcast, that there are a couple of ways you can stay in touch with us. We're kind of grassroots and we don't have a website, but you can always find our podcast wherever you find your podcast. And thank you for leaving the 5-star reviews and the ratings and for writing to us. We appreciate it. The best way to stay in touch with us is to go onto Facebook and join our Facebook group, Schizophrenia. Just go onto Facebook and search, put Schizophrenia Moms, and we'll pop up. So I thank you. We have episodes coming up about, well, there's a new book coming out called Awakenings with many stories of hope about recovery in schizophrenia. So we are interviewing Bethany Yeiser and one of the people profiled in the book as well. We have an Ask the Moms live episode coming up. And if you would like to join us and ask us questions, that is coming up. I have to check the date because we haven't really talked about this, but I'm hoping April 30th. And go to our Facebook page to find out about that. We are also going to interview the producer of a movie coming out called No One Cares About Crazy People, and it's going to be quite moving. It's been in the works for a while, and I've seen the trailer, and it's amazing. Later in June, well, Mimi and Mindy are traveling abroad, so we'll take a few weeks off while I sit in Connecticut. But Mimi and I are going to go to Baltimore in June and attend the Johns Hopkins Symposium for Families of People with Schizophrenia. And we're going to do our first like podcast when we're in the same room. I haven't figured out the tech yet, but I will probably invite Laura Pogliano to join us, who's a friend of the podcast and a fellow mom. And in July, Mindy's finally got an international clubhouse opening. So we're going to cover that as well. And also, many of you have asked us about what is going to happen when we're gone. And so we have done episodes on Planned Lifetime Assistance Network and on conservatorships. But my cousin Danny, who has done episodes with us for Social Security and how to apply, there's two episodes. Just look for them and very, very informational. Do it on YouTube if you can, because she has PowerPoint. We're going to do a show about pooled trusts with a legal expert. And she's going to talk in great detail with great expertise about what, after we're gone, what then? So,
Awesome.
yeah, there's a lot coming up. So just subscribe to our YouTube channel, follow the podcast, and stay with us. Many of you have written thank you so much to say that you don't feel so alone after finding us, and that's why we're here. We've also heard from listeners in Australia, and we may be talking to some. We've spoken to about Australia before because of the play that we covered. But we're just delighted to have friends all over the world. So thank you. Before we bring on our guest, Annie Sleese, who is the co-founder of the Mental Health Literacy Collaborative, I just want to say one little rant, which is that we all know that James and Jennifer Crumbly, whose son had mental illness problems, and they, I would say, not only didn't do anything about it, but perhaps they bought him a gun. Let's put it that way. And they're in jail for what their son did. And that's been in the news. But I want to add that we heard from a listener who wrote on Facebook to say, I don't know what to do. My son is acting out and they won't let us do anything and they won't let us help him. And he did go in the hospital for a few days and we took his guns away. And when he came out, they made us give the guns back because in that state, it was illegal to take away somebody's weapons. And juxtaposed with James and Jennifer Crumbly, it's just everything that I've always experienced of, they won't let me help. They won't let me do anything. They won't let me interfere just came out. And that just made me mad. That's all I'm going to say. And I'm done ranting.
That's a very gentle rant there, Randy.
I'm just like, what? You know, if you step in to try to help, they take it away. On a better note, Mindy and Jim just did made an appearance together. You want to just share a bit about that?
Just a bit. But first, I'll say I wish I could be with you at Johns Hopkins. I could not swing that trip, but I know you guys will do wonderfully. Jim and I had a chance a couple of days ago to be interviewed by a reporter from Minnesota Public Radio, and she's working with National Public Radio to put on a program for Mental Health Awareness Month. And they wanted some young person who has schizophrenia who's doing well. So Jim, at this moment, you know, not when Angela got married 20 years ago and not at a lot of moments, but right now, and I think I'm crossing my fingers, I think forever, but we know that is hard to have happen. But right now, he was an exemplary interview for a person with very serious schizophrenia who's doing well. And he just chattered away for half an hour with the reporter. Who knows what will end up in the program. And then she also interviewed me. And my interview focused on what does it look like at the beginning? I think they're thinking, just like this program, that so many people that are new to schizophrenia don't know what it looks like. And so that there's me talking about how Jim was at the beginning, then Jim doing really well. So I can't wait for this program because we're also educating people just like all of us who didn't know what the hell was going on when our sons started going off the rails.
So that's amazing. And since I work part-time for a local NPR affiliate, I will listen for the story. And if there's a YouTube version of it, we do have a playlist on our YouTube channel for our other appearances.
So it's not going to be YouTube. It was just audio.
Just audio. Well, you never know. Sometimes they just put the logo there. But thank you for sharing that. I was thrilled to speak with the Schizophrenia Society of York in conjunction with the Schizophrenia Society of Canada, and to be on a panel with two wonderful young and middle-aged men, Matthew Dixon and Christopher Grant, I think is his last name. He goes by XORAD on TikTok and has 1.5 million followers, talking about what psychosis feels like. And it was kind of like the conversation I wish I could have had with my son. So look for that, and we will hope to bring them on as guests on the podcast in the future. Okay. Thank you for the catch up, and it's been too long since we've seen each other. So now let's get to prevention. The title of this episode is Preventing Crisis, Mental Health Literacy, and Why It's Essential. If you have a loved one with serious mental illness, do you, like we, wonder why it took so damn long for someone to recognize the symptoms? Mental health literacy would have helped to prevent the crises that we've dealt with. So we have on Annie Sleese. And Annie, please turn your camera back on. And you are a co-founder and advocacy director of the Mental Health Literacy Collaborative. And the website is THE, like the mhlc.org. And so we'll put that in the show notes as well. And that's a nonprofit dedicated to making evidence-based mental health literacy foundational in pre-K through 12 schools and communities. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So it's near and dear to our hearts. So we always like to begin with our guests by asking you what brought you to this work. Can you tell us a bit of your story?
Sure. So I am in mental
health advocacy now, but only in the last several years have I been doing that. I was actually a classroom teacher for 25 years. I was an English teacher. I directed musicals and taught English. So not exactly the typical career path. You know, you don't go from teaching English to working in mental health advocacy usually. But with me, it was, it felt like the right thing to do. In 2017, I left the classroom after 25 years. And that was really inspired by my own personal experience navigating family mental illness, having no knowledge and no confidence doing it as a parent.
Was there a child of yours who we call it a loved one? Do you have a loved one with a serious mental illness? You want to say anything about that?
I do. Yeah. So my child, I have a loved one, yes, living with serious mental illness, and who has also now been justice involved. So at 18, which is usually when I start our story about age 18, my child was had just graduated high school, had a younger brother that was 13. And that summer, I was, and I want to tell this story through the lens of a mom, because I know you all are moms, right? And I think it's important to really think about what we see as parents. And looking back, I can, you know, hindsight, as they say, is 20/20. Mm-hmm. I see all the things I did wrong, but at the time I was doing the best I could, right? So at 18, he had just graduated high school and was really showing signs of what I thought was depression. And I didn't really have any good reason to think it other than I had been through bouts of depression myself and thought that's probably what it is, because I knew what was going on in his life. He was graduating and he was not going away to college, and a lot of his friends were. So I was just really making excuses for what I was seeing, the behaviors. Now, I was pretty good at watching my child and monitoring him, because at the age of 5, he was diagnosed with ADHD. And I don't know if you've had any conversations on your podcast about ADHD, but ADHD is often a diagnosis given to children that may end up, now I'm no clinician, so I don't want to speak from that experience, but that it typically or commonly turns out that it's not ADHD, or it's ADHD and something else.
Right. So it can, I don't want to scare anybody out there whose child is diagnosed. It can be one of the early indicators that can turn. It's something to keep an eye on.
That's right. That's right. And again, hindsight, right?
Right.
I didn't know that. No one ever told me that. And as a matter of fact, I was thinking about this. If you had asked me when my child was 17, does your child have a mental illness? I would have said, oh no, he just has ADHD. Right. So I never realized that ADHD is a part of that spectrum, right? It's a part of mental health conditions. But in anyway, I was good at watching behaviors and symptoms and appetite and all of those things since age 5. But at 18, it was different. And I had a sense that it was different, but I kept making excuses. And by that fall, my child's girlfriend called me and said that he'd shared he was intending to die by suicide. So for me, that was okay, well, I can't make excuses anymore. We need to do something. So, but again, he was 18. And I took him to be assessed, and he was willing to do that, but really it didn't go as planned, in my opinion. Ended up just agreeing to outpatient care. And the outpatient care was what I hoped would be enough. And it turned out that it wasn't. In fact, while my child was receiving that outpatient care, he befriended another patient. Now, remember, he's 18. So he's in with other adults.
Right.
he befriended another patient who sold him a firearm out of the trunk of his car during a smoke break during outpatient treatment.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Now, I don't know any of this at the time, and I am just witnessing that things are getting worse at home rather than getting any better. And younger brother and I are driving back and forth to middle school, and we are just holding our breath, really, not knowing what will happen. And ultimately, I'll cut to the main point here. My 13-year-old found the gun, but I will tell you, he did not fire it. No one was injured.
Was it loaded? It was
loaded. And my 18-year-old burst into the room. Actually, it was just a miracle the way it happened. My 13-year-old thought it was a toy. Had no idea. Like, we don't have guns in our house, so what is this? And brother comes in and goes, put that down. Mom's a single mom, and I have that for protection.
Oh my God.
My little brother wants to keep big brother's trust and all of that, so keeps it quiet for a while. But eventually, little brother, having zero mental health training or suicide prevention understanding or anything at all, was an amazing hero in this, and basically told me, having overheard big brother too many times, having overheard, you know, some threats and things that big brother had said. So that was, you know, I'd like to say that was the worst of it. I'll be honest. That was the beginning. That was the beginning of our story. And so if you were to ask what happened, that is the story I tell.
Mm-hmm.
But it's nothing but the beginning, really, because families in crisis, we're just waiting for the next crisis. And a crisis is an acute moment, but families in crisis just keep waiting for the next one. And that's what was going on. And because we didn't have the knowledge, my child hadn't learned about mental health in school, and I didn't know it, even though I had a master's degree as a teacher, I didn't understand what I didn't understand. You know, many years later, I would attend a NAMI event. And I know you've talked about NAMI on the podcast. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I worked for NAMI at NAMI Delaware, but I heard them say, and it just really stuck with me, you can't know what nobody ever told you. And that for me just really resonated, because I thought, yeah, nobody ever told me this, right?
That struck me so strongly as well when I first went to NAMI. I'm like, yes, wasn't in the manual. No one ever told me or warned me or suggested.
Yeah. It felt like someone was just keeping this all from me. And especially as I was learning how common mental health disorders are in general, whether, you know, 1 in 5 people will live with a mental health condition and 1 in 20 will have a serious mental illness. And 50% of lifetime mental illnesses begin by the age of 14. When I learned these facts as a teacher and as a parent, my jaw was on the floor. I was like, how did I miss this? Where was I? Right?
What did you do for NAMI when you worked there? And how did that make you pivot from being a teacher to what you do now?
Well, great question. So I actually volunteered a little bit with NAMI. I was the first thing I did was, are you familiar with CIT, crisis intervention training for law enforcement?
Yes.
So Delaware has a very robust program of CIT, and I was invited after attending a family support group, truly, and sharing, you know, a lot of what was going on and really connecting with the founders of NAMI Delaware. They invited me to speak and tell our family story at CIT on the day that they do family stories, so that law enforcement can actually see this from a different lens.
Right.
And by then my child was incarcerated. So it really was speaking directly from the point of view of, this is the parent of someone you could have arrested. This is the parent of, you know, a family member of someone. I did that for a while, and then I did some other work with Sandy Hook Promise. I was a national presenter for them. And again, just found their work so powerful that I just had to stay involved and realized that I think I should be doing this full time. So I left the classroom in 2017 and took a position as director of advocacy and education at NAMI Delaware. So my job was really to oversee the programming and the
the advocacy statewide.
Wow. So I will just share three quick things with you. I live two towns over from Sandy Hook. So I was actually on the air when it happened. So we all know about Sandy Hook. Also love musicals. my son is currently incarcerated as well. So I'm familiar with that. So tell us about MHLC and how you went from NAMI to that, and what are they doing? What is the mission? How are
sure.
you? Yeah.
Yeah. So at NAMI, I finally got the information I never had, right? I trained for NAMI basics, ending the silence, you name it. I trained mental health first aid and QPR. I had all the things and I was teaching them all, but I still didn't know that there was a name for all of those kinds of, for that body of knowledge, right? And that there's an evidence base around it. What happened was when I was working in the policy side of advocacy in NAMI, Delaware, I championed a bill that ended up passing in 2022 that was kind of the copy of a bill in New York that had passed in 2018. And that was requiring mental health education in schools for kindergarten through grade 12, pardon me.
For the teachers or the students?
No, for the students. So kindergarten through grade 12 students would learn mental health education. And when I saw that pass in 2018, of course, I just started at NAMI. I thought, yes, that is exactly what we need, right? And it took a while, but it happened in 2022. So now mind you, I'm a teacher and I'm a director. So I'm thinking like, who's in charge here? So I'm asking around in the national partners that I have, and I'm saying, so this bill passed in New York and Delaware just passed it. Who's coordinating these for the states? And I kind of laugh at myself now because that's a silly question, but I really just had no idea. I was thinking someone's got to be helping these states roll out the education part of this because it's not something educators are familiar with. Now, I knew that as a teacher. Most people don't know that. So when you pass a law like that and, you know, educators might be less familiar with this content, it's going to be harder to implement it.
And you know what? I'm a former teacher myself. And I also, when I was in the Minnesota legislature, anytime we put a mandate on schools, you know, what one more thing that teachers need to do, they're not always happy about it because their day is full and they have all kinds of things they have to get done. So how beautiful that you were a teacher for 25 years, because then you, as a mother with experience who's gotten yourself educated, can then speak to the teachers so they can they can hear you and not be some mandate from on high, and then you can persuade them. But my question is, how much persuading did they need? Because I always think a lot more people have mental illness in their families. They know about this. A lot of us think we're the only ones. We're carrying this burden alone. And so when you went to try to convince teachers, how hard of a sell was that?
You know, I was ready for it to be a hard sell. And initially, I think it was in the earlier conversations, I think it was a lot to your point, you know, kind of the idea of teachers have so much on their plates already, that kind of thing. And also that there were some initiatives already happening in our state that they felt like might meet what we were looking for. And when we continued to talk, and when actually, I remember it distinctly when it happened, I offered testimony in one of the committee hearings, and I shared our story. And another gentleman who I often advocated with also shared his story. And in that piece of testimony together, the people representing, you know, educators, the Department of Ed, they were just like, you're right. Everything we're doing, there can always be more to do. Like we can always, you know, it was basically like, I think eyes were opened as to just how profound it would be to allow children and their parents and their educators to have this knowledge early. And that's been kind of our message this whole time. And I'm not going to say it's been easy, because we do hear regularly at the MHLC that wow, there's so much on teachers' plates. How can you possibly, you know, ask them to do one more thing? And my answer is always, it's already on their plate. They are already doing this. And sometimes I joke that it's under the potatoes.
Perfect answer.
It's already on
their
plate.
Could you tell our listeners what MHLC stands for again?
Sure. Mental Health Literacy Collaborative. So we are literally a collaborative. There are three co-founders and a group of over 30 advisors, and they're diverse experts in fields of research, mental health, education, policy, advocacy, and they all come together. We all come together with a passion for mental health literacy. As a matter of fact, among our advisors, and this is something I'm just so thrilled to share, some of our advisors actually are the leading researchers in the field globally of mental health literacy. So we have some tremendous advisors. And I think that's just been such a help.
And this is a federal initiative.
It's not. It's not. We are a national nonprofit. We are working.
But it's not, but national.
Yes, it's a yes, I'm sorry. It's a national nonprofit. And we work in spaces looking at policy. And not that we're lobbying, we're not writing policy, but we're advising and guiding. And sort of to your point earlier about how to pass good policy, we're offering the support around what makes a policy have teeth, what makes it really stick. And those mandates you are referencing are probably not the best choice.
Right.
I'm sure you know. We also work
with- Can you give us an idea of where we are nationally? How many states do you know of that actually do this?
About half the United States it have something on the books, maybe a little more than half. It depends on how you're counting. So interesting. Mm-hmm. It's been an interesting ride as far as this research, and some great partners in the national space are working on putting together a map on this. And hopefully I can share that in the next podcast. But for now, I'm sorry.
One thing that you said, I want to go back to something that you said about your response about saying that the teachers are already doing this. That is such a salient point because they are completely already doing this. You're just proposing giving them the tools.
That's it.
You know? And so there shouldn't be any debate about it. I mean, it's ridiculous to send all these teachers out there. So actually giving them mental health literacy, giving them the tools to deal with this streamlines their work. It doesn't add more work.
And it actually, the research actually shows that it helps them too.
Yeah.
So it not only does it help the students because they're getting information early, it helps educators because educators are humans, right? We're all in this world together, and educators might have family members, they might have children themselves who could be, you know, experiencing symptoms too. So it really helps everybody. And what I'll tell you, interesting point to addressing that, our original goal was to just look at schools and work with schools. But what we found as we started, you know, working with our advisors and having meetings, we realized that you can't just serve students because you need educators and you need parents, and that's really a community. So we opened our mission up to be focusing on schools and communities. So now we're looking at things like the workplace. We're looking at first responders. We're looking at businesses and various spaces where this information could be valuable, because truly everybody needs it. And I was going to share before I forget the three things we do. So policy is one thing. Another thing we do is content identification, research and development. So we do not recommend any particular programming. There are programs out there, believe it or not. People say there are, I never heard of it. Well, we promise there are. And we are actually partner with a group who vets programming. So we can refer people to find a platform where you can find the programming that you might be looking for, because we really want everybody to get what they need, and different communities, different folks need different things. But we'll help those people find what they're looking for. And we'll also advocate for the research, and we'll advocate for the evaluation of those programs to make sure that if something's being adapted to suit a different community, that research and that evaluation is getting shared. And then
go ahead.
Well, the third thing we do, and it's been our priority so far, is advocacy and education for mental health literacy. So one thing I have failed to mention this whole time, and I would love to do it now, is to tell everyone what mental health literacy actually is. Would that be okay? Because that's really the primary thing that we're doing right now.
Yes, so, please.
Evidence-based mental health literacy includes four components. The first one is understanding how to foster positive mental health. And that could mean someone with an illness or without an illness. It's just understanding how to take care of your mental health. The second component is understanding common disorders and their treatments. And when we say common, it doesn't necessarily mean just depression and anxiety. It means anything people are aware of and we would think of as common. And I think schizophrenia falls into that because people recognize that term, whether or not it affects fewer people than anxiety and depression, but it's absolutely a common disorder.
And people don't know if there's actually more than twice as many people that have schizophrenia as have diabetes, for instance. So I don't think people realize how common it is.
Yes. And the key, I think, to that component is not only the understanding the disorders, but understanding that there are treatments, understanding the treatments and that they're possible, right? Because so much of this is the mystery of not knowing. And people—
Well, you know, so many of us, my son was diagnosed, you know, over 20 years ago. And I hear this repeated when people anecdotally tell me their stories over and over again, that the healthcare professionals basically will say, this is the diagnosis, it's schizophrenia, forget everything you ever hope for this human being's life. There's no real treatment for it, and just find a safe place to put them away till they grow old and die. And not only is that a horrible thing to say and to hear, but it's not even true.
That's right, it's not true. Well, I was going to share when we were talking about communities and the different services we want to serve, different groups we want to serve. Healthcare providers are one of those groups, because in reality, health literacy and mental health literacy are two separate things. They shouldn't be. Mental health literacy really should be dovetailed into health literacy, but unfortunately, it's not always included. So I'm sorry to hear that there have been people who've heard that false information. Okay, so the third component is understanding how to seek help, how and when, really understanding help seeking completely, right? So knowing when to seek help, how to do it, who to turn to, and so on. And then the fourth one is understanding stigma and how to decrease it, how to reduce it. And so mental health literacy has evolved, because originally mental health literacy was really only looking at serious illnesses and reducing or addressing crises. And it's evolved to be broader in recognizing how impactful, for example, stigma is and how important it is to understand how to get help. So those are the pieces that are really important to understand as part of mental health literacy. And it's what we're hoping that we can make happen in schools and in communities.
One piece of input, I would encourage you to broaden your stigma platform to be discrimination and stigma. Yeah. I'm on the board of Schizophrenia and Psychosis Action Alliance, and I chair their policy committee, and we're developing positions so that we can act on them. We do research, we do education also, and then advocacy. And based on research, we have discrimination is actually, stigma is related to discrimination, but discrimination is something you can actually legally do something about. If people are discriminated against, and a lot of, you know, it's a continuum, discrimination to stigma. But if you're denied a job or opportunities in life, that's discrimination. So I would encourage you to add that. My question is, you mentioned you don't sell products, so how do you raise your money to fund all of this? I'm assuming you're not volunteers like we are.
Well, it's been interesting. The funding is starting to come together, but it's been a lot of developing direction, right? So one of the big things that we're working on right now that we're just about ready to share news about, we can't quite do it yet, has to do with a project that would be funded pretty well. And that is a training that we're offering. And we're doing the training either way.
But this project would be a training for school professionals still in college. So teachers, pre-service, we're calling it pre-service educators or degree-seeking educators, because it could be people going back to school to get a master's or a doctorate to be an administrator. So anyone who's degree-seeking, working in schools or wanting to work in schools, we want to train them in a base level training called Mental Health Literacy Aware. And it's training. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. And next month being Mental Health Awareness Month, we hope to begin at least a pilot launch of what the training will look like. And it will be available in the community and it will be for a nominal fee. We're not looking to make a profit. It's certainly just cost covering, but we want to offer this at no cost in the higher education spaces. And that's what this project would allow us to do. And it's not quite ready for prime time yet. I can't quite share it, but if it happens, I'm going to be thrilled. And I would love to come back and tell you more about it.
Yeah, we would love to. It sounds like a lot of what you're doing, sounds to me like a lot of what you're doing could have the effect of early detection, early treatment.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, we have done many episodes about the need for that.
Mm-hmm.
I know in my son's case, you know, he still has anosognosia. He does not believe he has. You know, he called his sister the other day and said, you know, that thing mom thinks I have. Mm-hmm. Do I have to say I have it? You know, it's that.
Yeah,
that's where he is. That's mm-hmm. where he is. So,
yeah.
And I continually seek support to detach, which is difficult when he hung up on me today, when I told him my hopes for his future. And he told me I was only interested in being right. And that's the beauty when they can't call you back. I went, goodbye, clunk. Yeah. So I think it's maybe time for his injection and 2 days before it gets a little iffy, but early detection would have made a huge difference. And so mental health literacy would be a big part of that. So thank you for sharing all those priorities. I know we keep interrupting with questions, but I want to know, you know, what can people do? How can people get involved? What are your hopes and wishes for our audience and how they can be of use or turn to you for help?
Well, I would first recommend that they find us on our website, which is themhlc.org, themhlc.org. And at the bottom of the main screen, you can add your name and email address to our email list. We do not send out a lot of emails. It's only a couple times a month, but we provide updates on our projects and on our monthly events. And so the other thing they could do is join our monthly community practice events if they were interested. So we host a free, basically a Zoom meeting. It's a community of practice that happens every third Thursday at noon Eastern time.
And every third Thursday or every third Thursday of the month?
Every third Thursday of the month. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Every third Thursday of the month. And it is, it always addresses an issue that relates to mental health literacy, but they've differed quite a bit. So we have a toolkit that people can look at on our website. You can find it on our tab on our website. But one of our community practice events was the launching of our toolkit, which was around advocacy for mental health literacy. You can learn what mental health literacy is, why it matters, and how to bring it to your community. But our community practices are sometimes about school-related things. Like this week in the 18th of April, I don't know when this podcast is going to air, but we're having Delaware Department of Education sharing about how they're implementing mental health literacy education. In a future event in June, we're having a very special event that will be around youth advocacy for mental health literacy, because you know, our young people are asking for this. I know you've talked about NAMI on this podcast before. So NAMI did a poll a couple of years ago with teenagers and asked them questions related to mental health. And over two in three said they think schools should be teaching about mental health, including how and when to seek help. So we know
young people want this. And so we want to elevate young people and allow them a chance to really speak their minds on it. And we have a very special moderator. And again, I can't really share that quite yet, but I'm excited. And so if you add your name, you'll get to get the information from our email. And if you're on LinkedIn, you can follow us there too. We have a platform on LinkedIn. We're not on any social media besides LinkedIn though. And that is an intentional choice because of what we understand social media can be for young people. And we really would rather not be that, be kind of in that space with, you know, with the harm that it can do. So we're on LinkedIn, on our website, or you can certainly email me and I'm sure you'll share my email.
Anything else that we haven't asked you that you would like to talk about? We have a few minutes left.
I think checking out the toolkit would be really good, understanding where we're coming from in terms of why this is important. And, you know, you mentioned something, Randy, about it being about early signs. And that's really what we're hoping for. You know, it's kind of like Smokey Bear, right? Remember, what did Smokey Bear say? Only you. Do you remember?
Prevent forest fires.
So imagine if Smokey Bear only taught us how to put out fires. Because when it comes to the youth mental health crisis, that's what we're doing. We are putting out fires, fire after fire after fire. And the fires are coming too fast and they're getting more intense and we don't have the resources and we don't have the people to respond appropriately. And frankly, we're never going to get ahead. You know, one of our advisors says it this way, says, we can't only treat our way out of this crisis. So we have to get to the point where people understand more comprehensively about mental health and understand that it is in fact part of our health. Mental health is health. And whether or not people have a diagnosis, the earlier you understand what that looks like, the earlier you can seek the appropriate treatment and care.
I have a question.
The better off you're going to do. Yeah.
One thing I want to say, I saw on the website a quote, I think it was Nelson Mandela.
Desmond Tutu, right?
Oh, Desmond Tutu, that there comes a point when you have to stop pulling people out of the river and go upriver and find out why they're falling in.
Exactly.
And I think that's a very apt quote for this. The question I have for you, though, is what's your situation now with your son? And also, how's your younger son doing?
Great question. So, my younger child is doing really well. And I would say that it took probably, maybe a decade before we really overcame that trauma of all the things, you know, when you're going to visit your brother in prison, that's not something you really, and you're in high school. It's been really hard, but he's really embraced the idea of taking care of his own mental health, which I'm really, really proud about him. My older child, I'll be honest, we're estranged. And the reality is, unfortunately, that's kind of common. And I don't want to give any listeners, I don't want to take hope from you, but I want you to feel encouraged if that is your story, that it doesn't have to be that way and it doesn't have to last. And you can, you know, you can continue to, you know, forge ahead. The piece of my story that's interesting that I want to shine light on currently is that I have a granddaughter. There was a brief time when my child was married, had a child. And then, as I said, we are estranged and things are not necessarily great, but this granddaughter is the, you know, all, you know, all the great things about grandparents, what they say, I 100% agree. She's 17 months old. And the way I think about it, and I do talk to her mom, so I'm connected, but the way I think about all this work that I'm doing and the reason I got into it in the first place was I wanted to help other people before those crises happen. And if I can see my granddaughter go to school and learn about her mental health right along with the rest of her health. When she learns about her eyes and she learns about her lungs and she learns about how her body works, I want her to learn about her mental health. And if she does that, then we're getting somewhere.
Beautiful. I can tell what a wonderful teacher you were. And you're still teaching, obviously.
Thank you.
And as a grandmother myself, I wish that for all three of my grandchildren, that it should be part students to be educated, teachers to be educated, administrators to be educated, psychology majors to have it required to be educated so that we don't hear, oh, I think your son has ESP, which is one of the things I heard when he was having hallucinations.
Oh.
Mental illness as part of the mental health curriculum is not an elective. It is a necessity.
Yeah.
And I thank you so much for the work you're doing and the heart and love that you're putting into it. And we three moms wish you, Mom and Grandma, all the best. The website is themhlc.org. So it's themhlc.org. You can get on the mailing list and find out all about it and how you can support the cause or be involved and learn. And Annie Sleese, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for joining us for this episode of Schizophrenia, Three Moms in the Trenches with Randy Kay, Mindy Greiling, and Miriam Feldman. To get in touch with us or to learn more about our books, please visit our websites at miriam-feldman.com, mindygreiling.com, or randyk.com.